Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. The latest episode explores what would happen if you could make fear disappear and reveals the striking and rare case of a woman with no fear. From some of the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now and don't miss a single episode. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll dive into Selma, the civil rights film that may or may not be an Oscar nominee by the time you're listening. We'll get into the direction, the huge cast, the very Oprah of it all, and how it does at bringing one of the best-known American men of the 20th century to life. Then we'll expand out from Selma to other historical dramas to consider the question of dramatic license. Who uses it, who's granted it, and what are its limitations? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch.
Oh, indeed you are. Now, before we get started on this week's episode, I have looked at the agenda, and Stephen Thompson has listed his own name under Old Business.
Scrawled his own name.
Okay. Stephen Thompson, comma, Old Business. That's also my title.
So tell me, Old Business. How to start calling you Old Business.
Old Business. Actually, yeah, it should be O-L apostrophe.
Yeah. Yep. So tell me Old Business.
So last week, in what was making me happy, I referred to going to the ballet, and I managed to sound like a gigantic rube because I referred to the composer Tchaikovsky as Stravinsky. And I want to point out that at this event, there was a woman in front of me, you know, seated in front of me, who's talking to her friend after this production, and I overhear her say, "I think it's by Bach." And inside my head, I just think, Philistine. Now, that was karma laying eggs in my brain that hatched during the recording of last week's podcast.
Yeah, so you
my
just want to
apologies.
Acknowledge the Nutcracker is Tchaikovsky, not Stravinsky. Not Ignatowski.
Nope. Now, I knew that. I heard him say that.
I heard him say it too.
And it just went. And so neither of the explanations.
I don't listen when he's talking.
See, that's the thing.
That's what you have to keep in mind is that I'm just a salad shooter that just tosses words.
It's crazy.
It's the only explanation that makes sense is that we weren't listening.
Yeah. I need to start listening when you're talking. So one of the reasons why I thought it would be really cool to have Gene with us today is that Gene wrote a piece recently for Politico. Gene, why don't you remind the nice people who have not made it to this piece what the Politico piece was about?
Politico piece was about the groundswell of activism we saw around Ferguson and the movement that galvanized around Trayvon Martin, this new young generation of activists and organizers who are sort of beefing with the older civil rights establishment.
So that there's a little bit of a generational conflict, which you also talked about for a piece on NPR.
Right. And that's not a new generational conflict. It
was
a conflict that marked the civil rights movement, which, of course, gets flattened into, like, everyone loved Martin Luther King.
Right. And it was kind of monolithic.
Right.
So one of the things about Selma, now, Selma tells the story of eventually the march from Selma to Montgomery. But before that, the two kind of efforts at doing that march. So there's a series of three marches. And it deals a lot with the kind of political conversations that were going on between Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson, as well as between King's people and other activists who are already down there, including John Lewis, now a congressman, who was working at the time with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And one of the reasons why we're having a conversation later in the show about dramatic license is that there's been a big controversy specifically about the portrayal of Lyndon Johnson. And I wanted to make sure that we could talk about that because I think it's an interesting thing that raises a bunch of other issues, but I don't want to totally derail into that. So I wanted to talk about a bunch of other stuff about the movie first. The movie is directed by Ava DuVernay, who my favorite fact about her is that she was a publicist on The Help. She used to be a publicist. That was her long-time
career. That was not very long ago.
No, and she was still doing some publicity work on The Help. So any differences between this movie and The Help? Not necessarily coincidental. This project had gone through a whole bunch of directors, people who had been attached with varying degrees of seriousness, Stephen Frears and Spike Lee, and Gene's personal favorite, Paul Haggis, who directed Crash. That would have been a different movie.
The Lee Daniels, I guess Lee Daniels was originally... Yeah.
Lee Daniels.
Yeah. It could have been called Lee Daniels Selma.
Lee Daniels Selma.
Okay, so Gene, as a guy who's been kind of writing about a bunch of different eras in the civil rights movement, what first impressions did you have?
So the scene in which he's confronting John Lewis and they're having this conversation about tactics and who gets to be the face of this campaign was fascinating. So step back a little bit. One of the things that I was worried about when I went into this movie was, and I come to your desk all the time to complain about the evils of the biopic. And this isn't neatly a biopic because it has a sort of a fixed beginning and a fixed end. It's not about like the trajectory of King's life.
It's a segment of time in his life.
Right. It's this finite and discrete.
As opposed to like him from start to finish.
Right. Specifically about this movement more than about his life, though there's some of his life is in this.
Right, and King is probably, like, the easiest person to beatify, right? And, like, in the last 75 years, right?
Yeah.
You run the risk of sort of turning him into this non-person.
Right. It's a really hard thing not to do.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was watching the performance, David Oyelowo, in the movie. I was watching this performance, and I was thinking, the guy has a holiday.
Yeah,
it's really hard to do.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you have to make him human scale. And one of the things that Ava DuVernay does really well in her films is to make people human scale. She's really good at... She sets up a lot of tight shots with people talking to each other in sort of dark rooms and talking in almost hushed tones very seriously. And there's not a lot of... Some of the conversations between Martin Luther King and his wife and Martin Luther King and his aides and his lieutenants sound like conversations between real people. And Martin Luther King seems like a flawed person. I mean, there's points in this movie when you're like, this guy's kind of a jackass, right?
Mm-hmm.
And territorial.
And has an ego. And...
Right. And is unfaithful to his wife and a bunch of other stuff, right? And so this movie sort of does a masterful job of making him human scale. And I think also does a really good job of hinting at sort of a bunch of contemporary resonances without being sort of heavy-handed.
Without beating you over the head.
Right. Until Common's outro song on which he says, Ferguson.
Yeah, suddenly you hear Ferguson as the closing credits of this movie.
It's kind of like, you were already doing it. Don't gild the lily.
But there are a couple of things that I particularly loved about this movie. One of them, talking about the directorial choices that Ava DuVernay makes versus the sort of directorial choices that somebody like Paul Haggis would have made, she employs enormous amounts of silence. And as important as the music is in this movie, there's important score work being done. There's also important song work being done, including the song Glory that John Legend did that just picked up a Golden Globe. So music is very important, but the silence is every bit as important. And you have long scenes between people or long scenes of one person speaking in which there is no music behind them. And I really noticed and picked up on the silence in this movie. And that subtlety, I think, carries through quite a bit. I think the movie gets off to a tiny bit of a rocky, biopic-y start, where as it's introducing characters and having to do exposition on each one of them. It was funny when John Lewis, the young John Lewis, appears on screen, I go, that guy looks like a young John Lewis.
Exactly, yeah.
He does.
He does.
When he addresses him as John, I'm like, I'm right.
That's John Lewis. I bet that's a young John Lewis.
Yeah.
But I loved the way the focus on tactics and the focus on ego clashes, which aren't necessarily played for drama so much as you get a sense of what the behind-the-scenes conversations. Anybody who's ever tried to accomplish anything has conversations like that.
Right. Let me pick up on that because I share Gene's disquiet around the biopic, around any kind of dramatic history, because I always gird myself for this is going to be, you know, a take my medicine homework kind of thing, regardless of the subject matter. It doesn't matter what the subject matter is. If it's historical drama, it just feels like, because I am fatuous and glib and take the things seriously, I go into this defensive crouch, especially when the conflict that's being dramatized is to modern sensibilities so clear.
Yeah.
When you have some people who are on the right side of history and people who are on the wrong side of history, you know where the film's sensibilities are going to reside.
Right.
You know where your sensibilities reside. So it rarely becomes a thing of finding subtle emotional nuance. And what I usually look to historical drama to do is to fill out historical detail. This film does that very nicely with all those scenes on the bridge, something you've seen in documentary footage, but here you actually feel it. And it's not exploitative and, you know, button pushing. There's some of the restraint that Stephen talked about.
But it's very intimate. You get the sense of the physicality of the first march ends in essentially a brutal confrontation with the police. If you're not familiar with the history of that, there's an initial march that is basically turned back just as they're leaving Selma by a confrontation with the police. And the way she shoots the bridge is really thoughtful and really there's a moment later where she shoots the bridge and there is rust coming down from the letters on the bridge and it looks very reminiscent of bleeding or something like that. And it's very evocative. She does some beautiful, beautiful work around that scene, I think.
That said, this was produced by Oprah. And I think Oprah as a media figure and anything she touches has, it can be very noble and well-intentioned and still embrace that nobility in a very obvious way and really embrace the how well-intentioned it can be. This film does fall into that trap a couple times. That scene that you guys were mentioning where they're in the house in Selma and they're discussing tactics. What's their legislative agenda? What legislation should they focus on to get this thing up and running? I listened to that scene and I had two simultaneous thoughts. The first one was, wow, this is really stagey and really expositional. And B, this scene is doing good work. This scene is doing good, necessary work that to uncover some of those historical details that you need to know how to place this movement. You need to see these people disagreeing. It's hugely important.
Right. It seems like that would have been a conversation that they would have plausibly had before amongst themselves, right? I write about this stuff all the time, and I was like, oh, that is a very interesting point I never considered before. But it did seem very stagey,
You run the risk of flattening your characters and flattening the conflicts with this kind of approach into hagiography on one side and mustache twirling on the other. I think they largely avoided it with the portrayal of Martin Luther King, hagiography. You hire Tim Roth as George Wallace.
you're
kind of tipping the audience up. It's like, oh,
right.
Was Alan Rickman busy? We were going to dig up the corpse of Bela Lugosi.
Well, and similarly, there's a moment in this movie where you see Martin Sheen. And you
you just know he's going to be
on this. You kind of know what's coming when you see Martin Sheen.
I bet that man is going to be on the side of righteousness and good.
I bet he does something not racist.
Yep. To be typecast as the face of righteousness and good, that's an interesting thing
to be. No, it's true. And one of the things that I appreciated about this movie as somebody who grew up around a lot of Quakers and people who work in nonviolence was that the emphasis on the idea that nonviolence is not passive. That nonviolence doesn't just mean you don't do anything. It doesn't mean you just go and sing and, you know, that there was a tremendous amount of strategy around how to deploy nonviolence and around, in a lot of ways, the creation of the imagery that the film is really driving home was very important in bringing white people into that movement.
That they basically had to volunteer to be beaten up.
Right.
That they basically had to set the stage for the sort of a demonstration where you see these peaceful protesters getting hit with clubs. And they know that they and their volunteers are signing up for that. And there's a discussion of why and how.
Well, and there's that moment when Bunk from The Wire and the young John Lewis are drawing straws to wind up at the front of that initial march, it is because it is like being the first guys onto the beach at Normandy. I mean, it's a little different, but it's you are in the
you're
front
guaranteed
and you know
to
you're going to get it. And they know they're going to get it. And that's sort of how that unfolds.
There's a great book called The Race Beat by Hank Klebanoff. I think it won the Pulitzer a few years ago, maybe from 2005, maybe a little bit earlier. And it's sort of about how John Lewis and all those strategists actively courted the media through events like this.
Right,
and they
right.
And one of the things that's really striking about the book and listening to sort of John Lewis tell the story decades later is how much they knew when they went into these places that there was a good chance they were going to die. The civil rights movement is often sort of posited as people sort of making these moral appeals to people, and it was like much more thoughtful and much more, there was much more strategy involved. We see it briefly in which like they're preparing, they're like sort of getting people ready for what is going to befall them. Like, this is what's going to happen. Someone's going to grab you. They're going to throw you around.
Right.
This is how you do not respond.
And this is how they're going to talk to you.
Right.
And this is how they're going to try to bait you and try to get you to respond.
Right.
And this is how you're going to be treated. And I think it does a good job of driving home that for people who choose nonviolence, it is an act of enormous restraint. It's not a just kind of like, let's all be nice.
And that not everybody in your movement is necessarily going to adhere to it when everything is going down.
And when the winds start to shift and there are some changes there. But I enjoyed seeing this big cast. You know, the funny thing is Glenn mentioned Oprah, and I agree that there is an Oprah-osity.
There's an Oprah-osity.
That comes out in this film. But when I watched her in the opening scene that she does, there was part of me that thought, you know, there's part of me that really thinks it would have been cool if she had stayed an actress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like back from when she did like The Color Purple.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
If that had been what she pursued. Because I watched her in this and I thought, she's good in this.
She's good. Yeah.
Oh, she's good in this.
She's only, that's her only, I think, only speaking line of the entire movie, right? That scene.
Very early,
she's really good in it. She sort of brings this sort of like gravitas and sometimes a little like affected gravitas. I think it's to the movie's credit that it doesn't get absorbed by Oprah. She disappears really quickly. And David Oyelowo was fantastic in this movie. I mean, he sort of, you forget that he's king.
It's an impossible part.
Yeah, right. I mean, how do you play that part?
You forget that he's like a modern day saint, right? He just seems like a guy, right?
As close as you can get, I think.
Yeah, I found myself asking the question over and over again, how else would you do this?
Yeah.
Which is not a ringing endorsement of the film.
Right.
But like, yeah, okay.
It's true.
Roger Ebert used to have what he called the Stanton-Walsh rule, which any film that has either Harry Dean Stanton or M. Emmett Walsh in it has merit. I posit the Stephen Root principle.
Oh, yes.
Where any film with Stephen Root in it is just, he is playing a stock villain who has a layer to him in some sense.
And a little humor to him. And who I think, the thing I like about the Stephen Root performance is that you talked about the Tim Roth performance. Tim Roth has kind of already done a certain amount of mustache twirling and that kind of stuff, which is exactly what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Root has done a variety of things, but also has a real likability that he's employed in a lot of different, a kind of innocent likability. And for him to go at this particular role, I thought, that's an interesting choice. That's a little more than Tim Roth deciding he's going to play George.
There's a part of your brain that goes, oh, don't say that word, Stephen Root.
No.
But I think at the same time, having some amount of charisma makes a lot of sense. You're talking about George Wallace was a national figure.
Yeah.
And as much as what he was peddling had a populist appeal, for lack of a better word, you know, politicians have to be charming to a certain point, and casting Tim Roth makes a certain amount of sense. I did find with this movie, because they're trying to squash so much story into it, you get a certain amount of, why are they introducing this? Oh, right, I remember that name. He dies.
There's one character in particular who, when I heard his name, I thought, I think I know that name, and I think it means something bad's going to happen to him. And so there is a little bit of that. What Ava DuVernay and Paul Webb, who wrote the script, are trying to get their arms around here is so big, and there's so much, like, for example, I appreciated the fact, it's not underlined, but I appreciated the fact that the movie makes it very clear that women have a major role in being beaten up and in demonstrating and in participating, but they are not in those leadership conversations for the most part. And my understanding is there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
And women who were involved in that movement have said that she's just trying to do a ton of stuff. She brings in John Lewis, and I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the other guy from SNCC, but she brings in those dudes who are having those, as we said, territorial conversations about, you expect to come in here and now you're showing up and you're going to be the big hero. Like, the kind of stuff that really happens in any large endeavor.
And it's what we've been seeing in the Ferguson stuff. I mean, in late December, there was a big march here in D.C. and there was a Ferguson rally. It was organized by Al Sharpton's National Action Network. But there were all these kids from Ferguson who were like, hey, we started this. This was a movement that we started. We organized on the ground. We were protesting. We were marching. And you weren't there. And they were beefing with him. And they were going on this, like, back and forth via social media and in person. That's the thing that sort of marks all movements. And it's the thing that we sort of miss in the civil rights movement. We get this weekly reader version of our history about this. That's sort of like, it was just morally right, and they won on the strength of appealing to everyone's, the better angels of people's nature.
Eventually, everyone just said, well, we can't have that because that looks terrible.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Right.
So that looks monstrous.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it did a really good job of sort of encapsulating a lot of those things. And it's not a perfect film by any means.
Right.
But it was the best case scenario for a movie in which Martin Luther King is the central figure.
I think that's right. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And if you saw Selma, let us know what you think. Now, the thing about Selma that we are tying into this second segment, in the film, Lyndon Johnson is played by Tom Wilkinson, preeminent not Southern actor, but British actor.
But with a very Lyndon B. Johnson face.
With a very Lyndon B. Johnson face. Glenn has been taking the position that he was born to play it. And the way that he comes across in the movie, and let me know if you guys would disagree, but I think the way he comes across in the movie is heart mostly in the right place, but feeling like he wants to drag his feet until they undertake the Selma marches, at which point he winds up having kind of a confrontation with George Wallace, in which he concludes that he has dragged his feet long enough, and now it is a matter of siding with Martin Luther King or siding with George Wallace. Then he goes and proposes the Voting Rights Act, and that's kind of his triumphant moment in the movie. Now, there have been several historians who have come out and said, including a couple people who worked with Johnson, a couple other people who have said, this is not a fair portrayal of Johnson. He was not obstructionist, at least at this point, about these particular marches. And it has opened up this whole conversation about historical dramas taking liberties with facts. Is that a fair rundown, Gene?
Yeah, that's pretty fair, yeah.
Is it your sense, as it is my sense, that if it is not fair to say that LBJ was dragging his feet at this moment in history, that this idea that there was a certain amount of push-pull about how fast to move on civil rights legislation, especially since, as he points out right at the beginning of his role in this movie, they had just passed the Civil Rights Act. Is it fair to say there was a certain amount of back and forth about the timing?
Sure. I mean, those conversations were absolutely happening, and they sort of marked the civil rights movement, and they dogged Kennedy, and they dogged Eisenhower a little bit less, but they dogged Kennedy, and they especially dogged Johnson. The movie sort of may have fudged a little bit on the sort of accuracy of the conversations. Of course, we can actually verify those things because LBJ taped all those conversations in the White House. This debate we're seeing in newspapers from like LBJ lieutenants and former aides, it seems to be a lot about the difference between accuracy and truth, right? I mean, this is the movie is true to the spirit of this sort of frustration by the organizers and the activists that things were not moving fast enough, even if the details are not exactly on point.
Right. There's a useful distinction to make here. Did I ever talk about the film The Fourth Man, the Dutch film The Fourth
Man?
I don't
think so.
Paul Verhoeven?
You may have.
I may have. Okay, so basically it's a film that Paul Verhoeven made before he came to Hollywood with Jeroen Krabbe playing a writer. And the way it's a very weird sort of psychosexual, slightly gay Hitchcock kind of movie. It's a lot of fun, but it's deeply weird. He establishes that this writer, who is our protagonist, is a pretentious jerk by having him at the outset of the film come give a speech that's where he says, "I am a writer of fiction. I lie the truth." I find that you don't trust historical fiction. You just have this reflexive thing that something is going on here. And when you start to suspect that the fudging has to do with making good drama and not with accurately portraying what was going on, or at least distilling what was going on in a useful way. I mean, like we talked about Fruitvale Station, did Oscar Grant really rescue a dog? Or were you just trying to shoehorn some kind of, like trying to make this guy more human in a very ham-fisted way?
Build in a big metaphor.
Build in a big metaphor. Or did the Revolutionary Guard in Iran actually chase the plane at the end of Argo? Or did Affleck just need a big, you know, punchy closer for his film? And in this film, in Selma, did John Lewis and Martin Luther King have that discussion in the car where King is expressing a crisis of confidence? Or did the second act just need some punching up?
Well, or is that a thing that was a dynamic that was true but not a conversation that was true?
Right.
And I think when I watch a movie like this, I look at these conversations between, for example, Martin Luther King and his wife. You think, well, obviously these are invented, right? Yeah. This is not a movie where she sat down with the people who wrote the script and said, "Let me tell you word for word what happened in this conversation." It's all invented.
I don't know. Their conversations were probably bugged.
That's true. Right, that's right. But you do get to that point where, on the one hand, my approach tends to be the same as Glenn's, that I am more interested in whether the underlying thing that you're saying is true as opposed to whether the specific detail is true. At the same time, I know that if it was me and it was my guy and it was somebody that I knew, and in that situation my guy didn't do that, I know I'd be frosted and I know I'd say that's not fair to my guy. And in fact, I read a thing where Ralph Abernathy's family looked at this movie and said, they don't show him enough. He would have been in more of these meetings. He would have been in the meetings with the president. King never went to these meetings by himself. He would have taken Ralph Abernathy with him. And so everybody gets frosted when it's their guy, and it's completely human and totally understandable. But what I get aggravated about is when how big these controversies get seems to have so much to do with whose ox is getting gored.
Yeah.
Because how many movies can you look at? Stephen and I were talking the other day about Lincoln. How many movies can you look at where the entire issue of race becomes a conversation had among a bunch of white people? Mm-hmm. When you are downplaying the entire contribution of a bunch of powerless, nameless people, that's fine. Mm-hmm. When it is one powerful, named person, with a lot of people who are still highly placed allies of that person.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, you can't get away with kind of that lying the truth sort of thing. And that's what bothers me. I just want it to be the same rule for everybody. And if it was okay for Argo, and if it was okay for Lincoln, I mean, people complained about Argo, but it didn't stop it from being Best Picture.
Right. And there is a certain amount of, is this going to affect this movie's Oscar chances? Well, excuse me, but it's up against The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything.
Yeah, both
of which certainly do their share of playing around with stuff. You mentioned Lincoln, and I think I saw so many parallels between this movie and Lincoln that I kind of felt like some of them were deliberate. This movie that is focusing on the person applying pressure to the figure in power, whereas Lincoln is about the figure in power. And you never see Frederick Douglass Lincoln. And that is infuriating. Mm-hmm. Like, you're talking about a major, major, major historical figure who had a colossal impact on how things went. And in some ways, I mean, it's 100 years apart. They're similar stories.
Yeah.
It's people applying pressure. You know, you have Johnson. One of the ways in which I think LBJ is a more sympathetic character in this than he's somehow made out to be is he has just had this massive legislative accomplishment and feels like that should buy him some time. Like, I just accomplished this. I'm not even thinking about this right now.
And I'm on to something else. I'm on to Vietnam.
And LBJ was nothing if not the consummate political dealer. And that was how he got a lot of stuff done in politics. And there was, he was always kind of talking to all sides to try to get things accomplished. And I thought that was interesting. As much as there are ways in which he is cast in an unsympathetic light, I think he swears in this less than he did in real life. It treats him with some fairness. But the parallels of Lincoln, which did all kinds of this sort of squashing and eliding.
Were there any abolitionists in Lincoln, let alone any black abolitionists in Lincoln?
The character played by Tom Lee Jones, whose wife is...
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Lincoln is very much about his heroic white guys. And, I suppose you had to have heroic white guys. But to leave out all the black people...
Yeah. Right. The people who are sort of the center, the cause in which they're fighting are like an abstraction in that movie. Well, totally an abstraction.
And the people who are endangering themselves just as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
This is one of the first big conversations, actually, that Gene and I ever had was about Lincoln and Django. And kind of the way that those movies played in interesting ways with whose story was... Who's and for me, what makes me crazy is the idea that if you just never mention people at all, that's fine. But if you mention them and then you underplay what they did or you misrepresent what they did, particularly in a specific moment, then all of a sudden that's something that can't be tolerated. But I understand the purpose of taking this guy who basically knows what the right thing to do is and presenting him as having to be pressured a lot to do it. If you read the letter from a Birmingham jail, right, that's what that whole letter is.
That's right.
That whole letter is your good intentions and your good heart do me no good at all. They are worth nothing to me, and your insistence that everybody wait and be patient and be nice and maybe next year is of no good to anybody. So I understand why they felt in making this movie that it was very important to put that aspect into the story.
Absolutely. But let me play devil's advocate a little bit. It is as true in cinema as in life that detail-oriented people make lousy storytellers. And this is a classic fault with first films, with student films. The idea that you must assert everything equally means you're not asserting anything.
Right.
You're not making the choices that you need to make as a filmmaker. Not realizing, for example, that when you put one scene in front of another and you edit them together, we in the audience make connections between them that you may not have intended.
Because our
brains work like that. There's pattern recognition. This is why I'm sensitive to, in dramatic fiction, in historical drama, when the mistake seems to be one of storytelling, of narrative, of pure narrative, as opposed to getting it right. Because this is the push and pull that we're talking about, the accuracy and truth, and both of those things. It would be great if they were discrete ideas, but they're not. They blend together all the time.
Yeah. I also think there's something to be said for accuracy becoming so much more important the closer you are to the present.
Right.
And you know, Linda and I were talking earlier today about how so many of these people are still alive. You know, I mean, John Lewis is still in Congress.
Right, yep.
And so you have people who are able to argue, as opposed to, say, Pocahontas, whose story was pretty different from the one that plays out in the Disney film.
And it means you get them, among other things, it means you get them commenting. My understanding is that what Andrew Young said about this movie is everything is right except Johnson. This is not a straightforward portrayal of what it was like to deal with Johnson at this particular moment in life.
Right.
Now, a lot of people have pointed out Johnson had a long career of opposing civil rights legislation before this. Mm-hmm. So this whole like gradual coming around is certainly a thing that happened in his life for whatever reason, just maybe not at that moment.
Not at that moment, right.
And if you're curious of John Lewis's take, there's the book Gene mentioned. There's also a graphic novel called March. It's a trilogy. First one came out, I think, a couple years ago. The second volume comes out this month that he's done with Andrew Aden and Nate Powell. And that tells his story. Book one only goes up to sit-ins at lunch counters. Doesn't get quite to here, but he will soon be telling that version of his events.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you asked at the top of the show who we grant artistic license to and who we don't. I find that for some big, stupid historical drama, for example, that takes a huge event and peoples it with a bunch of fictional characters. Your Pearl Harbors, for example. Big, crappy movie that they spent a lot of money on. I want to see stuff get bombed, and you're going to people it with all these stock characters. I don't care about that. You can do whatever the hell you want. Because what you're trying to do is show me what it looked like and go through some of your BS, you know, rising action, dramatic action with Ben Affleck, and it doesn't matter.
It's basically no different from Armageddon.
Yes, you know? Exactly. It's the same thing. So there, I cut you all kinds of slack. Do whatever you want. Tell your little story.
Yeah, but you could take Pearl Harbor.
And people were mad about Pearl Harbor.
Okay, but you could people Pearl Harbor with totally fictional characters and have them do things that would be just as misleading about what was happening at the time, what that event was like, what attitudes were like, as anything that you could say about real historical figures. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's almost like it frustrates me that once you start writing fiction, you are completely free of this idea that you have any responsibility to represent the truth as it actually is.
That's a really great point. I mean, and there's so much. I mean, if we were talking about race and gender and the sort of representations of the old days. I mean, you can go. There are so many movies that do that, right? That sort of like erase or minimize.
Of course.
These big sweeping currents that were true in all these parts of American life.
Well, it's like, what's the truth or falsehood of Gone with the Wind?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the Civil War is real, but the people aren't real, and yet. Mm-hmm. Makes all kinds of contributions to what people think the Civil War was
Absolutely.
And wasn't, and the South was and wasn't. And
or, I mean, Birth of a Nation, right? I mean, it was like a seminal American movie, right? That's almost not fair to represent Birth of a Nation. But,
but I know what you're saying. It's like, it frustrates me a little bit that you only have these conversations when there's an identifiable face of a person
sure.
that people can say, true or not, of this person. I'm much more concerned about representations of reality that don't necessarily have any connection to actual reality.
Would I mean, the conversations about race and Mad Men in particular are always sort of about, like, well, would they have that much contact with people of color? Like, I mean, and that's always a sort of a fascinating conversation, right? Is it true? Which is, obviously, it's all fake, but I mean, is it true in what it's conveying about sort of their relationship to their staff, but also to the you know, the elevator operator?
And that's perhaps a good way to get back, to circle back to what Glenn said about true versus accurate. The things in Mad Men that you can measure for accuracy are things that have a connection to reality.
Right.
Like, is this really a car that existed at that
right.
time? Is this really a way that people decorated their houses at this time? The thing that gets at truth is things like, what would contact with people of color have been like, and on a personal and character level, does this feel like a human?
Right, this is like an actual human
and
exchange.
And ultimately, it's like, does this feel like Lyndon Johnson is one question. Does this feel like any human is
right.
another question that you run into in
right.
lots and lots of movies. I don't know. Well, again, I'm curious to hear how folks feel about this, how they feel about Selma, how they feel about, you know, by the time you hear this, the Oscar nominations will be out. So
mm-hmm.
I'll be interested to hear what people think. So find us on Facebook or on the blog. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I am in this bizarre state.
You are. I don't know.
All the time, always. But particularly now, I am in this bizarre state of anticipation, where everything that I'm thinking about in pop culture in particular, and work in particular, is about to happen. So I'm preparing to do the Austin 100 for South by Southwest. I'm preparing by watching all the Best Picture nominees, which I'm, you know, proud of myself, because I think I've got just about all of them. I'm excited about, like, the NFC Championship game is, like, about to happen. Gene and I watched the Packers beat the Cowboys. house, which talk about things that are making me happy this week. But it's also this, I mean, this like brief interregnum between victory and probable disappointment. Like I said, it's more of the state of mind where I'm like sitting on top of a water slide, but instead of water, it's work. And eventually I'm just going to be, whether I'm ready for it or doing it or not, it's going to be happening to me.
Yeah.
Knowing that a gigantic discovery process is ahead, that all of these things that bunch up at the beginning of the year are all about to happen to me, whether I'm ready for them or not. Hint, I am not.
That is excellent. I very much like that, making you happy this week entry, sir. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Three things. Linda, have you checked out Agent Carter yet?
I have not.
Okay. This is really good. It's much better than the show it's replacing on the schedule. Uh-huh. It's replacing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Hayley Atwell plays the same character she played, Peggy Carter, in the first Captain America film. It's a period piece set right after World War II, where she has to adjust back to civilian life, or at least she's still a spy, but it's spending a lot of time dealing with the return of women to domesticity following World War II. It's paying a lot more than lip service to that. There's an entire subplot where we keep seeing this radio drama of Captain America, where the single woman character is always in need of rescue, and how just annoyed she gets at that. This thing has real stakes, and she's creating a very selfless, practical, incredibly efficient spy. The dialogue is clever, but it's not Whedon-esque clever. Mm-hmm. It doesn't follow those rhythms, because obviously it can't, because it's set in 1946.
Sure.
But it's really doing a lot of good work, and it's really entertaining. A second thing is, this last week, a comic came out called The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl Number 1 by Ryan North with art. This amazing art by Erica Henderson. I don't have to tell you, Linda Holmes, that Squirrel Girl is a mutant with the proportionate strength and agility of a squirrel.
You don't have to.
Don't have
Unfortunately,
to.
You did.
So the plot of this is that she leaves Avengers Mansion, where she's been on the deep bench of the Avengers for a long time, to go to college with her squirrel companion, Tippy Toe. It's just six different kinds of fun and charming, and if you're looking for an all-ages comic, this is the one. It's great. And finally, The Americans is back on FX. This is a solid, smart show about Soviet spies in the United States in the 1980s. It's tense. The performances are great. Kerry Russell, I never watched Felicity. I didn't know from Kerry Russell, is playing a Soviet spy who is cold, but not cartoonishly cold. She is human. You actually see some life behind the eyes. The producers, as long as the producers keep in mind the one thing that Homeland should have taught us, which is that it's never about the kids. no one cares about the kids. Keep the focus on the couple, and we're good. And finally, because they are constantly donning disguises, this show has a wig budget bigger than a Cher farewell tour. So
it's true.
It's really true. So it's just so good. The Americans on FX.
A lot of wigs on The Americans.
A lot of wigs.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Furious co-signers to The Americans. So last year saw the end of Jet Magazine. I don't know if you ever saw Jet Magazine. It's like a Reader's Digest.
She's like, I don't know if you guys ever
saw Well, you know. It's a Reader's Digest sized magazine. It was sort of ubiquitous. It was in your aunt's house. It was the beauty shop. No one subscribed to it. It just like arrived at your house. You know?
Supermarket shelves for a while.
Yeah. But it was the end of, last year saw the end of its print run. It moved to digital only. But the company that produced it, Johnson Publications, used to produce a whole bunch of other magazines like it called like Q and Tan and Sepia.
Tan?
I'd never heard of any of these until last week.
I actually subscribed to Beige.
Oh my God.
Steven's a big subscriber to Pasty.
I never knew that until last week when I stumbled across this Instagram page called Vintage Black Mags, and it's just covers. It's just covers of those old out-of-print magazines from, like, late 50s and early 60s. There's, like, a magazine with, like, Eartha Kitt on the cover and a Bob, and the cover line is, like, you know, why Eartha Kitt will never marry. they're just really dope, really fun old pictures. Vintage Black Mags on Instagram. And then there's another thing I found on social media, which was really fun. There's a Twitter handle called Crap Taxidermy. The handle does all the work for you. You don't need to explain it.
So it's like Cake Rex for dead animals?
Yes, for dead mammals.
Cake Rex for taxidermy is... Ooh, evocative.
It's very fun.
Yeah.
You will giggle.
Nice.
Crap Taxidermy and Vintage Black Mags.
That is awesome. Thank you, Gene Demby. Stephen Thompson, ask me, Linda, who do we love?
Linda, who do we love?
We love our audience.
We do.
We love our audience. And we are asking, because we love our audience, we are asking them for a favor. We are doing our favorite thing, which is We're doing some audience research.
Sweet.
Who doesn't love research? Now, to do this, we need help from you. Once you hear this, there's going to be a survey available, and it is at pchhsurvey.org. And what they're going to do here is they're going to ask you some questions about the show. This is what I want you to understand. Take the survey. That helps us. And be honest. That helps us, too. We are really trying to get some information about people's reactions. And it's not a thing of, like, we're not focus grouping deal like Glenn Better or Stephen Better.
They're going to replace me with Ted McGinley.
It's nothing like that. We're really trying to get a sense of where people's heads are. As you know, if you listen to the show for a while, we've tried a bunch of different things. We've done live events. We've done all kinds of other stuff. We're really curious about what you think. It will help us make the show better. So please go take the survey. It's at pchhsurvey.org. And do not be afraid to kind of be honest. I mean, you know, be gentle. No, I'm just kidding.
Be honest.
Be honest. That's the point, and that's what will help us. So that's the first thing making me happy this week. Second thing making me happy this week, I've talked about this before many, many times. As you hear this, we are into the final season of Parks and Recreation on NBC, which is kind of being a little bit, to me, bum-rushed out of town. There's a final run of, it's either 12 or 13, but they're running them back-to-back on Tuesday nights. This is a show, you know, if you know me, you know how much I love Parks and Rec. If you follow me on Twitter, you have seen Alan Sepinwall and me throw Parks and Rec clips at each other for long periods of time just for the heck of it. Everyone knows my love of Chris Pratt. Everyone knows my love of Amy Poehler. The producer, Mike Schur, who developed this show with Greg Daniels, they're bringing it in a little bit, I think, on their own terms. This is 7 seasons. They managed to not get canceled, yeah, even though they were constantly on the bubble. I think they're going out at what is theoretically, to my rational mind, a perfectly fine time for the show to end. My irrational mind is gnashing its teeth and sobbing uncontrollably, but I'm so happy the show is back, and I'm going to run home and watch it because I love it so much. So what is making me happy this week is getting to spend my last few weeks with my friends in Pawnee, Indiana, on Parks and Recreation. So that is what is making me happy this week. That and the fact that you all right now are going to pchhsurvey.org and helping us out. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. And you can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE 215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. And our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. And you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thank you so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. The latest episode explores what would happen if you could make fear disappear and reveals the striking and rare case of a woman with no fear. From some of the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now and don't miss a single episode.